Next Step 634, July 30th, 2020.
Hi there, this is Susie from In His Shoes Ministries. Thanks for tuning into the Next Step with Father Vodskin. We are the voice of Armadoxy, a weekly podcast started in 2008 that looks at life through the lens of Armenian Orthodoxy. If you're joining us for the first time, we're so glad you're here. And if you're a regular listener, welcome back. In these weekly episodes, you will find that Father Vodskin's messages are timely, thought-provoking, and based on the solid principles of Christ's love, faith, and hope. Now, let's get ready to take the next step.
So today you're going to get your answer, okay? You've been waiting for it. You've been asking, how realistic is it? People ask me, how realistic is it? What you're talking about? You've heard me say it. Yeah, you don't fight fire with fire. You fight it with a hose. You fight it with water. How realistic is it? How realistic is it that you can put out that fire with just a hose? At some point, don't we need to show our might? Don't we have to show our toughness? Don't we fight that fire with fire? And if somebody's going to come against us in aggression, shouldn't we have that aggressive attitude back to them? And what I've been teaching is really the teachings of our Lord Jesus Christ, who must know something beyond what we know, right? Obviously, I mean, look at our world. Look at our world. We're not doing too good on the war front, right? War after war after war after war. Isn't it time we start saying we need different approaches to life? Not only for countries, but even as we deal with one another as people. Is there a way? How do you deal with violence? Can you deal with it via nonviolence? Big question. People ask me, how realistic is it what you're teaching? I mean, it's really good. You talk about Christ, you talk about Christianity, but isn't that like pie in the sky? I mean, we live in a real world where people have guns, people have bombs, people beat up each other, they hurt one another, there's physical violence. What are you talking about over here? Well, today, we laid to rest a giant here in the United States. His name was John Lewis. Happens to be the last survivor of those speakers that spoke on the Great March in Washington. We've all heard the I Have a Dream speech by the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. I have a dream that in the end people will be judged not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. Today we laid to rest a giant whose content of his character spoke volumes about the dignity of the human soul, about the power of nonviolence. And I'll be honest with you, I could not leave that visual. I was glued to the YouTube feed this morning from the funeral. It took place at the Ebenezer Baptist Church, which was the church that, if you know your history, Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. was the pastor of that church. That's where he grew up. That's where he pastored. That's where the civil rights movement was formed, put together. And actually today in his eulogy, President Obama referred to, it is with great honor back in Ebenezer Baptist Church, in the pulpit of its greatest pastor, the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., to pay my respects to perhaps his finest disciple, referring to John Lewis. John Lewis was 23 years old when the March on Washington took place, when he heard the I Have a Dream speech. In fact, not only was he 23 years old and being there, he was also on the program. He also spoke that day at 23 years old. And you see his life, a dignified life, and the praises to God, the praises to Christ during this service. I'm going to put a link on today's show notes. It's a while. If you really feel like watching something that will really stir you, take a look at it. I know, kind of morbid. We're going to watch the funeral of somebody. Well, you know what? It's more than a funeral. It's a celebration. What was he, 80 years old, and it's a celebration of a life, but it's also a celebration of victory without your standard, without your standard operating procedures. Here is a man really committed to the nonviolent movement. I was remembering today as I was watching the show, what was it? It was just before coronavirus hit us. It was in January. It was at the annual Martin Luther King commemoration. I was invited to a special breakfast with one of the people who was a student of Dr. King, and he was talking about the issue of nonviolence. I shared it with you at that time. He's talking about religious organizations getting rid of the metaphors. And we talked about this just last week. We talked about when we read in Ecclesiastes, you know, there is a time for love, there is a time for hate, there is a time. Is there? Isn't that written in the Old Covenant? Yes, it is. And the New Covenant says something much greater than that. There really isn't a time for war. There isn't a time for hatred. Because let me put it this way, okay? And I think this comes through so well during the Civil Rights Movement. When Dr. King went out for freedom, when he was involved in the Civil Rights Movement, he understood that we had to appeal to a greater power than the small forces that we have. You know, it's like the coronavirus. It's a tiny, tiny, tiny little virus. And Jesus says, if you have the faith of a mustard seed. Well, you know, mustard seed is really tiny too, but it's much bigger. It's much bigger than the coronavirus. And I want you to think about that metaphor for a moment. We always talk about like changing the world. Is there a metaphor? Is there something? Is there a weapon that is greater than the bombs, greater than the guns, greater than all of the weaponry that we have? Yes, there is. And Jesus is telling you that there is. Why are we refusing to listen to it? And here we are again. We're fighting fights. We're fighting fights that, at the end of the day, cannot be won. And I don't mean this about one side or the other. All it does, fighting, just it just brings out more aggression. You're only going to get more people mad at you. Yeah, you could stand there and you could insult somebody if you wanted to, because you know that you could flatten them. But what's going to happen? That person is going to resent you, is only going to grow up and come back after you in another form. It might be, you know, 10 years later, might be 100 years later, but they'll come back after you, their children, because we haven't learned the lessons of life. And we still solve our problems by beating up, by being more forceful. And today, when we watch the funeral of John Lewis, it was an opportunity for us to reflect really, truly on the power that we so often talk about, but we are unsure of. Why? Well, because we don't have the examples. Where do we find this? Well, you found one today. Today we get one. Today we have an honest-to-goodness example in Congressman John Lewis. And I want to share with you today some thoughts about this example, about this life, about this giant, as I said. And giant because he lived through that history, but not only lived through it, but he sacrificed, he gave. And the thoughts that we talk about here on Armadoxy, when we talk about the next step, what's necessary, it's about making those changes in life, not only in your personal life, but on a grand scale. How can you do that with the pressure, with the temptation to go out there and to just hit evil with more evil? Can you overcome it with the good? And of course, Congressman Lewis, being a disciple of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, being a disciple of Jesus Christ. And I got to tell you today in the funeral, some of the gospel music, the prayers, they were so moving. I mean, Christ was alive in the people and in the death. This is what it means to live forever. In the death of the congressman, you saw Christ. That life of Christ is being explained, expressed by the love and the goodness that he's doing. So let me share with you a couple thoughts that President Obama, in his eulogy, shared with us. He began his eulogy with a quote from James, from the book of James, the letter of James. He says, "Consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance." I mean, the words that he picked, I mean, it was just, like I said, I'm going to put a link on today's show notes. If you have some time, you really should watch this. But what does James say? Consider the pure joy. Pure joy. Whenever you face trials of many kinds. Because you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance. Let perseverance finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, lacking nothing. Powerful words. And I say that powerful because, if the apostle of Christ is telling us this, if Christ tells us this, why do we second guess? Well, because we're people, right? And we don't have enough examples. Like, we know that when you get out there, it's the bullies that win. We know it's the tough guys. We know the guy that has the more weapons, that is stronger, is always going to win. We don't have enough examples. And that's why when I share with you stories from the Armenian church, from our Armenian fathers, when I tell you that here's a group of people that are living at the intersection of three continents that had no military strategy, and yet they've been able to overcome, persevere, and today they are thriving. This is why I tell you there is a power that is greater than what you're seeing all around you. And so it's necessary that we days like today, when you have the opportunity, it's necessary to point to examples such as John Lewis. It's not about the politics. It's about honoring somebody who did it, who became that faithful servant. President Obama challenged us. He says, imagine the courage of people Malia's age. Malia is his older daughter. So John Lewis, this story that he shares with us is when John Lewis was 20 years old. So here in the South, in the United States, the Southern states, there was a lot of segregation. There was Jim Crow. And basically, if you were black, you could not enter couldn't go into a diner and eat with the white people. You couldn't even go to the bathroom. There would be bathroom for, they wouldn't call them black, they'd say for colored people and white people. Okay, talking about toilets. Yeah, let's be straight out, not to take baths only, but yes, the toilet. You couldn't go in there with white people. And the same was true on buses. If there was a white passenger, that white passenger had the right to sit up front, and the blacks would have to be in the back. So President Obama's talking about just right after the Supreme Court ruling came out. Let me share it with you. That same year, just weeks after the Supreme Court ruled that segregation of interstate bus facilities was unconstitutional, John and Bernard Lafayette bought two tickets, climbed aboard a Greyhound, sat up front, and refused to move. Greyhound. I'm trying to think as I'm reading this. I'm trying to think for our audience that's outside of the United States. Greyhound is a bus line, okay? They climbed aboard a Greyhound, sat up front, and refused to move. This was months before the first official Freedom Rides. He was doing a test. Trip was unsanctioned. Few knew what they were up to. And at every stop through the night, apparently the angry driver stormed out of the bus and into the bus station, and John and Bernard had no idea what he might come back with, or who he might come back with. Nobody there to protect them. There were no camera crews or to record events. We, you know, sometimes, Rev, we read about this and we kind of take it for granted, or at least we act as if it was inevitable. Imagine, says the president, the courage of two people Malia's age, younger than my oldest daughter, on their own, to challenge an entire infrastructure of oppression. John was only 20 years old, but he pushed all 20 of those years to the corner of the center of the table, betting everything, all of it, that his example could challenge centuries of convention and generations of brutal violence and countless daily indulgences suffered by African Americans, like John the Baptist preparing the way, like those Old Testament prophets speaking truth to kings. John Lewis did not hesitate, and he kept on getting on board buses and sitting at lunch counters, got his mugshot taken again and again, marched again and again on a mission to change America. Spoke to 250,000 people at the March on Washington when he was 23. Helped organize the Freedom Summer in Mississippi when he was 24. And at the ripe old age of 25, John was asked to lead the march from Selma to Montgomery. And this, of course, is a very famous, noted event that took place. And a few years back, they even made a movie about it called Selma. Highly recommend that you see it, but even more that you become familiar with this piece of history, American history. Because here's the thing. It's the ability to change, to make change. It's the ability to do it without violence, and it's the ability to do it with respect for all human life, yourself as well as others. To understand that what Christ talked about began with an inner power of the inner self. You know, especially in the Armenian church where we have all these rules and regulations, and, you know, like during Lent, you got 40 days meatless, and you do fasting days on Fridays and Wednesdays, and you've got a whole assortment of different things. People say, well, why do we need to do this? Even the most simplest thing, we need to go to church and commune. Why? You know, God does not need that. That's one of those myths, and I hate it when priests get up and say, you should do this because, you know, God will be angry. God could care less whether you give up meat, whether you do 40 days or 100 days or don't do it at all. It's not about God. It's not about doing it for God's sake. It's doing it for your sake. It's about a discipline. It's about strengthening the inner self, so that you can take on the challenges of the day. What John Lewis did, what the freedom fighters did, what Dr. Martin Luther King did, these were not just haphazard incidents. These were training. They were trained for this. And this is why last week I think I was a little bit vocal about it, and I heard from a few of you. Thank you. It bothered me that they went out to, the Armenians went out and demonstrated against the Azeris, and they broke out in line dances. It bothered me that they went to these demonstrations and spoke Armenian rather than speaking a language that could get the message out to people. I mean, we know our story, right? We know our story. But even more, it bothers me that we put aside the most precious gift that we have, namely our Christian faith. And we relegate it to some kind of a ritualistic position in our lives. Like when I need a baptism, a wedding, a funeral, I'll call up my priest. Rather than understanding that within that priest, within that church, there is a message of salvation, there is a message of hope, where there is a message of resurrection. Something that the African-American community, the Black community here in the United States was able to tap into. And here's the kicker of it all. You know, for the last several months, we've been seeing a lot of people want to talk about history and changing the past. And I even shared a little bit of it last week on a personal level when we talk about the Armenians and Hagia Sophia. And Hagia Sophia was first, of course, a Greek church, Christian church. And then life changed and the Ottomans took it over, became a museum after that, and then it became a mosque again just last week. There's a lot of talk about how do you change the past. Let me share with you something that happened just a few days ago. After his passing, it is customary to what they call lie in state, they lay him in state, in other words, his remains, his casket, in a place of honor. John Lewis was the first Black lawmaker to lie in state in the U.S. Capitol Rotunda. And it was also taken to the state of Georgia Capitol to lay in state. Now, why is that so unique? Because just 50 years ago, 1968, when the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated, they refused him that honor. So it takes time. And yeah, that is a part of history that was ugly. But you can't erase that history. And it goes back to what James says in the scripture, which Obama quoted. It's about, like, take a joy in what you're going through. It's basically another way of saying the popular thing. If life gives you lemons, make lemonade. Get with the program. Then it's not going to be a perfect ride. There's going to be some difficulties. But what John Lewis does is he applies the teachings to his life. And this is what we've been talking about here on The Next Step. This is the idea of walking in the shoes of others. This is the entire theology of Armadoxy, is that you can tap into something greater. There is something greater than that fire out there, and that's that power of love. We just need to believe in it. Believe in it enough for us to follow it, for us to apply it to our lives. Because here's the truth of it. You need to make a lever long enough. As Archimedes says, you can change, you can move anything if you have a lever long enough. We need to make that lever long enough. In other words, the troubles of the world, and especially, I was talking last week about the Armenian Azeri thing. When you look at it, the odds are against us. And that's nice that you could get romantic about it and say we're strong and everything like that. We have a greater power. We have a greater strength than the weaponry that's been handed to us. We just need to be able to apply that. And that's what the teaching of Armadoxy is. That's what leveraging love is all about. And what I've shared in videos and talked to you about. So today we get one more example. God rest his soul. And God give us a chance to look at that life and pick up the examples. Keep him alive in our lives by keeping the example, what he teaches. He was a disciple of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. Even greater, he was a disciple of Jesus Christ. Today he becomes an example for us of what that power of Christ is all about on a daily life, in the real world, applying the power of love, applying in our lives a nonviolent resistance to the evil that's around us, and coming out victorious via a resurrection. You know, every week we take a musical break. We play a little song, give us a little bit of time to digest the first portion of our show. And today, this is a heavy-duty one, right? A lot to digest, but also gives us a chance to celebrate some of the beautiful music that's all around us. Today, I stumbled on this. I can't remember where it was. It just popped up on one of the feeds and the socials that I was on. Anyway, it is System of a Down's Toxicity, but performed by Alvaro Galán, also known as Algal the Bard. Yes, you guessed it, the Bard. It is medieval instruments, music being presented to you as he presents Toxicity by System of a Down. Toxicity. Should I have said, of course? Maybe not. Maybe it took a minute to figure out that by System of a Down, but it is performed by Alvaro Galán, also known as Algal the Bard. And yes, you guessed it, the Bard. This is like medieval music, isn't it? Medieval style, instrumentation. Well, it turns out that I just stumbled on him. It turns out that this particular song he had recorded back in 2017, and I went into a lot of his music on YouTube, found out that he's been recording, and even as close as just a month ago, he does a lot of covers, which are beautiful. Some of them leave you a little bit wondering, like, what? You know, I can't remember, there was a Queen song that I said, okay, that one's not going to do it for me. But this one was nice, the instrumentation, the way it came out. And I'll put a link on today's show notes. Do check him out. Do check out this video, but check out all the beautiful music that he's put together. And like I always say, important to support musicians. It's important to support artists because it's a different way of expressing something beautiful. Let's see, Galán not only composes this version that you just heard, but played each and every traditional instrument, thus making the otherwise heavy metal song sound like it was written in the Middle Ages. A small item that I found on the internet. I'll have a link on today's show notes. Do check it out. I wondered why he didn't do any Ian Anderson or Jethro Tull. Then I figured out, yeah. It already is medieval. It already does have all that nice, beautiful melodies coming out from all over the place. Anyway, I digress, as I often do. I want to share with you some ideas about difficult people. Do you have difficult people in your life? And this is kind of like one of those ideas that came out from one of my parishioners. We do a Bible study once a week. By the way, you know what? Our Bible studies take place in Glendale, but now, since the pandemic, we've been doing it by Zoom for the past few months. If you are interested in joining our Bible study, it takes place Monday night at 7 o'clock. It's 1 hour, 7 to 8 o'clock. That's Pacific time. Now, I know that's a problem because most of you on the East Coast of the United States, that's already like 10, getting ready for the midnight hours. But especially those of you in Europe, forget it. It's like early morning. Nobody does Bible study early in the morning. But if you are interested to join us, please drop me a line. I'd love to have you join us. It's a 1 hour Zoom meeting talking about all things that are important to us as we do on the next step. So last week I got an interesting email from one of my parishioners in the Bible study and said, can you talk about difficult people? And I said, yeah, of course I can. My life's filled with difficult people. And I started thinking about that. And isn't everybody's life filled with difficult people? And maybe this is why somebody's asking me this. So I put it out to the Bible study group. I said, this week we're going to talk about difficult people and how to cope with them, how to deal with them. Boy, I got responses like you wouldn't believe. Yeah. In fact, a couple people who couldn't make it. Oh, please share the notes with me. I have to know this. And you realize that more and more, yeah, difficult people are difficult people all over the place. And really, it's the same story we were talking about a few minutes ago, right? I mean, when you talk about the civil rights movement, aren't you talking about difficult people on a, you know, amplified or exponentially great? When you're talking about races that take over other races, you talk about political regimes taking over others. I mean, it all begins with these basic little ideas of who's difficult and who's not. So I took the challenge. I said, let me see what this is all about. Let's see if we could talk about, if we could identify who are the difficult people in our lives and how do we deal with them? What are the ways in which we deal with them? And, you know, I'll be happy to share with you some notes about, you know, who are the difficult people, how do you deal with them. It's not what we're going to do today. We're going to go a little bit more fundamental. Like, what does it mean to be a difficult person? Because, you know, the person who asked me to talk about this, she shared with me a video of Rick Warren. Yeah, you know, what was the name of that book? Purpose Driven Life. And he gave a very good analysis, and I was impressed. It's the first time that I watched him. I knew who he was, but first time that I actually watched an entire video of him. And you know, methodically he goes through what are difficult people, who are difficult people, and how can you deal with them, or what do you do, and these scenarios, and so on and so on. So it was very, very interesting. That's not what I want to do today. I want to talk about fundamentally, what does it mean when you say somebody is difficult? Why do we all have difficult people in our lives? And if we all, listen to this, this is what I meant by fundamental issues. If we all have difficult people in our lives, then ipso facto, it means that we are a difficult person in someone else's life. Yeah. If we all have difficult people in our lives, it means that we are a difficult person in someone else's life. And basically, we're talking about the human condition. And we're talking about it to that extent that we understand that now, all of a sudden, yeah, this is a very common problem because it touches every single one of us. So who are these difficult people? And you know what? Let me just identify a few because I thought these were fascinating. In the Rick Warren scenario, what he presents, he says, there's demanding people, people who are little dictators, disapproving people, people who nitpick, and they're unpleasable. You can never please them. You can never do, you know, you can never give them satisfaction. Yes, Rolling Stones can't get no satisfaction. There's people who are deafening. In other words, they talk over you. So if you're in an argument, they just go over and over until you get just sick of them and you say, okay, I surrender. There's people who are destructive. In other words, they're like a volcano. You don't know when they're going to blow up, but when they blow up, whoa, watch out. Lava going all over. People who are discontented. They're touchy, thin-skinned, crybabies. They have the martyr complex. Oh, do we Armenians know that martyr complex? I think it's kind of like built into the genes, right? And he identifies as demeaning people who have smart mouths. They're just outright rude and insulting. Okay, so for the sake of our conversation, let's think about these six scenarios. And you realize that as you talk about them, you can possibly fall into one, two, perhaps three, perhaps all of these categories, because we each have our moments. And in so doing, it begs the question, what is the proper way? What is the right way? The reason why I'm saying this is because I have a big issue, and it's becoming more and more to the forefront. When we talk about faith, when we talk about issues of faith, when we talk about matters of truth, that most people approach faith illogically. What I've been trying to share with you through the years on the next step is to give you an idea that we can logically approach faith. When you understand that prayer, or like I said earlier today, when you understand that the things that we do in the church are not for God, but they're for ourselves, to better ourselves, to give us those skills that are so necessary in life. When you understand that Jesus Christ came to this life so that we can be reconciled not only with God, but with one another. By reconciliation with God means that we are reconciled with one another. In other words, a world where there is no war. He came into this world, and what was the first message that was given to us when he came to this world? Peace on earth. goodwill towards men. When he leaves, what does he say? I leave you my peace. I give you this peace like the world cannot give. Take it. It's about peace. Peace means harmony. It means getting along. It means being in tune with people that are in disagreement with you, but the ones that you call uncomfortable, difficult people, you will find that those difficult people probably think others, including you, might be difficult in their lives. And if so, then we got a serious problem on our hands, right? Okay, so one of the approaches to getting along with difficult people is to thicken your skin. Oh, that's good. And in fact, Rick Warren in his talk said it very nicely. I like this one. He says, it's important that we thicken our skins but keep our hearts soft. In other words, we usually do the opposite. We are thin-skinned and have hard hearts. In other words, we're not out there trying to look at the good things in life. We're hardened. I like that. That's a very nice way of saying it. But let's take it a little bit more. Let's go a little bit further than that. Thick skin. And that's okay. But you know that with thick skin comes also when that skin gets thick, you may have a soft heart, but it's very difficult to get there because of the thick skin. So I think that analogy kind of like falls apart when you really think about it. There's goodness inside of each and every one of us. By toughening our outside just means that it gets more difficult to get to the inside. So how about, instead of like a thicker skin, how about if we start understanding that we have that our only salvation is to approach one another, that our only salvation is really through the love that we have towards one another. And this is not a cliche. Don't think that this is just an easy way out. Actually, it's much harder to approach it by love. Just like we talked about earlier today in the civil rights movement, it's easier. It would have been easier to pick up a bunch of guns and start shooting. What do you mean we're not going to sit in the on the counter? Just shoot it up, right? What do you mean I can't have a seat in this bus? Shoot it up. No, it's much more difficult to approach it by love. By saying that, you know what? I'm created in the image of God. I recognize just as much as you are, so am I. And therefore, we have to find a commonality. I have to be able to see the image of God inside of you. Wow. Now we're talking something else, aren't we? We're talking on a different dimension at that point. And in that dimension, it's okay to be logical. Because it's a religion, because it's faith issues, doesn't mean it has to be illogical. In other words, we have to find means by which we talk to one another in an understanding. For instance, do you ever think about this? That, you know, you look at somebody that is in a cult, quote unquote cult, because it's very easy for somebody to turn to you and say that you are in a cult, right? I mean, we go to a church where we all get dressed up in vestments. We sit in pews and there's a certain order and everything. Arguably, somebody could very easily look at that and say, what a screwball group of people, right? Just as we do many times by looking at others. You look at other people and you say that, okay, like, man, what are they doing over there? They're excluding people. They're doing that. These guys are cults. These guys are a part of a cult, and they're illogical. Okay. When you start realizing that they could look at you, then you start putting up some rules and regulations. Okay, what is a cult? What is a religion? To me, religion is defined as something that will enhance your life. The minute it works against your life, against the beauty of life, about the most intricate things in that are so necessary for life, the beauty and the art that we see in our lives, then it's not from God. Now, that's a definition that I've given. Other people will say, well, you know, this is what my definition of religion is. But in my world, it works because I'm able to now say that if you are apart from that. For instance, when I talk about Jehovah's Witness, I never talk about Jehovah's Witness being the wrong faith. Okay, because then you get into a subjective thing. I don't believe in what they believe in. They don't believe in what I believe in. You look at it and they'll take a scriptural passage and they'll say this about it. They'll twist the scriptures and they'll do it. They will look at me and they'll say, you know what? They take a scriptural passage and they twist it and go on. So all of a sudden we're now at the same place and we're arguing semantics. I don't argue on those points. I argue on what are you doing to improve the human condition? I've had weddings in my church where Jehovah's Witness members of the family would not attend. In fact, on a couple occasions, parents would not attend because it was inside of an Armenian Orthodox church. Now, to me, that's wrong. To me, anything that lessens the dignity and the value of life is wrong. And so on that premise, I'm able to say that they're wrong. Not on the theology, but how does it work in life? And it's the same kind of idea when we talk about difficult people in our lives. It's the same kind of idea when we talk about governments and countries. You look at what people do. They take a look at the government. They say, well, they don't agree with us. They have a parliamentary procedure. We have a democratic procedure. We elect our officials. They have a parliament. Over there, they have a dictatorship. But what's the bottom line on it? How do the people live? Are the people living in goodness? Are the people able to prosper? Are the people able to enjoy a quality of life? Again, I know that gets into subjective because the rulers of any place will say, yeah, of course, everybody's doing fine. I think it was just this morning I was hearing an economic report on Cuba. Reminded me of the old Soviet days because apparently because of the economic times, they need hard currency, namely dollars. And so what they're doing is they're opening up what used to be called dollar stores. I know today in America, our dollar stores are places where you could buy things cheap. In the Soviet Union, we had dollar stores where you could go and use hard currency. But it was always an ordeal to get into these stores. You'd have to prove that somehow you had the right to have dollars. Well, I heard it this morning that in Cuba, to get the dollars, the government is opening up dollar stores, places where Cubans can purchase things with dollars. They get these dollars from relatives in the States. So Cuba wants them to purchase these items at very high prices, so the government could then tap into those dollars, and those dollars, of course, on the world stage, can buy them things. So all of a sudden, what happens is the quality of life diminishes, and we see that we have economic issues there, right? So you can arguably say that these people are going through some difficult times, are not as well off as others, and then you start into the argument of, well, we have a better system, you don't, and those arguments escalate into wars. Instead of just talking and understanding that each of us has a way of dealing with our lives. But we come up against a very real concern. You see the suffering in somebody else, and you as a good person wants to alleviate it. We see this all the time. You don't even need to go to countries. There is a program called St. Jude's. They do some incredible work with young cancer victims. In fact, the part of their whole premise is that cancer victims do not pay anything. Instead, it comes by donation. So people see these poor children suffering from cancer and you donate to that cause. The same thing when you talk about refugees. You did 1,000 different charities that you can participate. Why does anybody participate in there? Because you see this human suffering and you realize that you have a responsibility, maybe you have an obligation, or maybe it's just the soft-heartedness. Maybe we shouldn't look too deep, right? You see that these people are suffering and you want to bring about some help. But it gets you to the point where you realize that, hey, you know, their way of life is different and it needs to change. I felt this when I was in Africa a few years ago, and I was inside of one of these small little communities that had undergone genocide just a few years back. And we were inside that community, and just horrible, horrible poverty. And we're inside the villages, actually, and you're seeing that they don't have the resources to take care. And you're immediately, what your head goes to is like, these people shouldn't be having 9 to 10 children. Each family has 10 children there. Immediately, you start thinking that, oh, wow, why doesn't somebody introduce birth control? Well, when you stop and you put your foot in the shoes of others and you look at their lives, you realize, oh, wait a minute. Somebody did introduce birth control to these people. It was called genocide. They thought they'd clean them out. And so, of course, these people are having more and more children. So you realize that all of a sudden my values and their values are completely different. You understand that everybody wants the best for people. And so now you start getting into a point of understanding. And that, I'm telling you, is the first step in a resolution of all conflicts. Because we always talk about love being this incredible weapon, being this tool that we have at our disposal. But we don't know how to dispense that love. The reason? Because we don't have the understanding. And that's why we came up with the idea of walking in the shoes of others. It's not about love. It's not about walking in the shoes of others. It's not about love. It's about the precursor to love, namely understanding. I know it's difficult to walk 20 miles. Walk that 20 miles in another person's shoes. Now I understand that person's difficulty. So all of a sudden that difficulty comes on a different plane, at a different focus, on a different dimension. So we're now finding common language by walking in the shoes of others. By so doing, that common language becomes the groundwork for dealing with difficult people. Our difficulties in this life are basically each and every one of us seeing our life somehow better than the other person, so much so that we have the right to fix their lives. Now, think about that for a moment. What are we talking about? Not just personal lives, we're talking about community lives. Think about what happens inside of countries battling it out. Somehow I understand that my way of life is better than your way of life. Why? Think about that in preferences. My preferences are better than yours. And it doesn't work. It doesn't work. One of the greatest tools that we have at our disposal as human beings is emphasized by the church, and that's self-evaluation. When we talk about sin and confession of sin, it's not about like you're going up to God. Like God has already forgiven you. Get with the program. It's been told you're forgiven, okay? But we need that forgiveness. We need that forgiveness. And it begins by us understanding that we're all equal in this world. We're all the same. We're all people. We all have the 10 toes. We all have the 10 fingers, the nose and the eyes, the mouth. The few people that don't, yes, we need to tend to them as they request. Those of them that cannot request, we understand that, yeah, there is an obligation as human beings to be able to take care of the suffering in the world. And slowly we start understanding that in that goodness that we share with others, there are opportunities for us to understand others. That understanding is the foundation. It's really the foundation to overcoming the difficult people in our lives. I'm going to leave it there, okay? There's just a few more things on my notes, but I'm going to leave it because I think I'm just kind of like getting to a point where I'm starting to get excited. Like, I want to go out there today and start a new life. Just trying to understand everybody. I want to get out there today and just kind of like say, okay, difficult people, you know what? And a smile in your face, because I could do it. Yeah. It's very special because, you know what? If you're listening to this podcast, you are probably of that means. And I don't mean this in any other way than except the fact that you're listening to a podcast, which means you have some kind of internet access. It means you have some kind of electronic media by which you can listen to it and everything. So in other words, you have some means that are way better than many people in this world. And so there's a delicate balance. How do you balance the goodness that you have by sharing it with others? And I think that the more we share, the more we love. It's really an expression of an equation that has to do with the understanding that we have towards others. Once we start understanding, we don't need the difficulties. We don't need to be the difficult problems in other people's lives. And we understand their difficulties as just a reflection of how we look at difficulties. All right, you know what? The piano player came in. I gotta give it up. Here's Susie. Be back in a couple moments.
Susie here again, popping in to say thank you to you, our listeners. We are thankful for your prayers, kind expressions, and donations. You make this podcast possible. Your listenership and support has allowed us to grow and expand our ministry around the globe. We are grateful to be able to touch so many lives and create lasting friendships. At epostle.net, we are determined to bring apostolic evangelism to an electronic world and look forward to your continued support. Thank you and God bless. We now return to this week's Next Step with Father Vazgen.
Okay, thank you, Susie, and thank you to all of our listeners. What wonderful letters that you send, your notes of encouragement. I want to share with you a couple things that are going on personally in my life. First of all, I have an incredible book collection that I've had for years, and I really love them. But I'm realizing as time goes on, I do need to not dispose of them, but I need to pass along some. I cannot dispose of them. I love them too much, but I would love to find some good homes to people, with people. If you're interested in books, I'm in the process of just shooting pictures of all the titles, you know, right on my bookshelves. I'd be happy to share them with you if you're interested in some of the books. I'm not going to give away everything, but a good portion of them. But I want to make sure that they go to a good home. That's number one, okay? Number two, there's a couple items that are coming up. We're going to have a prayer rally Friday night. For many of you who are listening to this podcast, that's tonight. We produce these podcasts Thursday here in California, and I know by the time it gets to most of the world, it's already Friday. So Friday, we're going to be on the Western Diocese Facebook page. We've been streaming every night. This night will be a live one with a group of people. Amid the COVID pandemic, we're sitting there, and we're going to get together. We're going to be praying with masks, with social distancing, but we're going to be praying earnestly for the peace in the world. And it's like I said today, it's that practice. It's that ability to come down on our knees that makes us, that gives us the tools, the necessary tools to do some of the bigger things, engage in some of the bigger opportunities to shed love and peace in this world. So if you want to join, do check it out. It's Facebook, Western Diocese, where I do a lot of my work. And I'm very, very proud of that work. We have started a deacons organization. We have started a Bridging Generations organization and some fun stuff that you could read about on our webpage at the Western Diocese. Of course, you can check out all of my stuff on In His Shoes, which we are revamping, but it's taking much longer than we wanted to. We also have our Epostle, which is in desperate need of facelift. If you're inclined to help us out on any of these programs, drop me a line. I would love to hear from you. You can reach me at feedback@epostle.net. Epostle is apostle with an E. That's Apostolic Evangelism for an Electronic and Expanding and Exploding Universe. You know, we get them all in there. Okay, music tells us it's time to go. Listen, August 16th, Astazazin, we're going to be in the village of Yetem. If you're in California, do plan to be with us on that day. Social distancing and all. On behalf of the wonderful crew who put today's show together, Susie, our producer, Ken, our engineer, this is Father Voskin, inviting you to join us again next week when we will take the next step.
And now here's the fine print. The information and comments presented within this podcast and our website do not necessarily represent the views of the Armenian Church hierarchy, but are presented as a challenge to define the dynamics of Armenian Orthodoxy in all aspects of life. Listening to these shows is habit-forming. Addictive behavior associated with the next step is rarely, if ever, remedied. Rather, the next step is known to relieve and cure common cases of narrow-mindedness, prejudice, numbskulledness, and glaucoma in patients over the age of 20. Results may vary depending on credit rating. Findings are based on double-blind studies conducted in Istanbul and Jerusalem. Side effects include mind expansion, clarity of focus, higher rates of heart palpitations, sensitivity to the pain of others, and occasional nausea. The management and production crew of epostle.net take full responsibility for changes you will experience. Not valid with any other offer.
Take your breath, cut out.